Out there, oh, peace is calling in the bonds of love we meet for the world anew.
Welcome to Muffin Talk.
Kia ora and welcome to Muffin Talk. Muffin Talk is a weekly radio program to which I invite guests to talk about their work and their passion for issues on community programs, social justice, Bible studies, or the Catholic Church. Today, I have invited Father Merv Duffy to a Zoom recording for a broadcast. Father Merv, a very warm welcome and hi to my radio program.
Thank you very much, Beate. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Father Merv Duffy is a Marist father and theologian with a special interest in art and church history. He is head and lecturer in theology at De Kuppinger Catholic Theological College in Auckland. Recently, Brother Kieran Finn gave a presentation on the infancy narratives in Jesus' early years with Titi Ponamu Study and Joy. One of the questions that came up after the presentation was about how we knew what the angel Gabriel really said to Mary during the visitation. These and many other questions might not be too obvious when reading the New Testament, but that's why we Catholics have the Old Testament, so the Hebrew Bible, the New Testament, and the apocryphal writings. Father Merv, can you tell us more about these apocryphal texts?
Right. The key thing is maybe just to sort out that word apocryphal, because it has a negative connotation for many people. But its original meaning was worth reading. Ooh. So something apocryphal was something worth reading. And the important thing to realize is that the early Christians were part of a literate culture. They wrote letters to each other. You know, we're used to Paul's letters. There was lots of writing going on. Not everybody could read and write, but they employed scribes who could do both. And so between those church communities, there was much exchange of documents. So the New Testament emerges into a culture of writing. And so there are other things being written other than what lands up in the Bible. So we call the texts of the New Testament canonical, because they get in the list of the canon, they become part of the Bible. But at the same time, say, the Pope, Clement I, writes a letter. So the first letter of St. Clement, that is a post-New Testament bit of writing. It's an historical bit of writing. It's really important and interesting, but it didn't make it into the Bible because it doesn't have the sort of apostolicity, it doesn't have the status as the inspired text.
Father Merv, you mentioned now several times didn't make it to the Bible. Was there a competition or something?
Effectively, yes. The texts were competing to be accepted. So church communities made a distinction between something that was read out, proclaimed. So a gospel gets proclaimed, a letter of St. Paul gets proclaimed, gets read out, and what we would probably effectively call spiritual reading. Other documents that were valued and considered worth reading, but didn't have the same status. So Matthew, Mark, and Luke circulate quite early, but John's gospel took some time to be accepted. Some of the later letters and the book of Revelation, it's actually a gradual process, the gathering together of the canon. There's a fascinating document called the Muratorian Fragment, which gives an account of second century Rome and gives a list of the documents that were accepted and were not. And you can see it's not exactly the same. It's very, very close to our final canon. But it's not until the 4th century that a church council actually lists all of the books of the New Testament. And in a sense that the canon gets fixed. So the edges of the Bible were a bit blurred, and there were other competing writings. And with regard to your Christian legends, for example, there is a very, very important document called the Protevangelium of James, which is a second century writing. Now, notice it's connected to an apostle because it's associated with James. We believe that it is not written by the apostle, but by the document making the claim of an apostolic authority, it was trying to be considered along with scripture. Mm-hmm. Maybe little sidetrack. The Shepherd of Hermas, another early Christian document. The Letter of Barnabas, another early Christian document. We've got a very famous New Testament called Codex Sinaiticus, which is a massive, beautiful, highly expensive volume that has those two documents bound in as part of the New Testament. So you can sort of see they were ones that almost made it, or at least as far as the community that produced Codex Sinaiticus, that community considered that they had made it. But later, the processes of the formation of the canon cut them out. My mention of the Protevangelium of James is it's one that the church does not consider to be inspired text. It's not canonical. You don't hear readings from the infancy gospel of James, but there are stories in that have influenced the life of the church. It's from there that we get the names of the parents of Mary. Mm-hmm. So it starts with the story of Joachim and Anne, a rich couple who were childless and were praying about that and about Joachim going to the temple to offer sacrifice and being turned away because he did not have a child, which is an odd, there's an oddness to the story, but so Joachim and Anne, those two names, we have them in our calendar of saints. They've made it into the liturgy. They have a feast day, and that is all from the apocryphal gospel. So it's not Bible, it's not canon, it's not inspired text, but it's been enormously influential. And Christians have always asked stories about the gaps in the Bible account. And legends grow up in response to those gaps.
Even if you think of the first gospel was written in the year 70, that's 70 years of oral tradition. There would have been a lot of questions been asked.
Remember, Jesus lived to 30 or 33. So, and your 70 is approximate, but you are right. We have a generation of oral tradition. So the storytelling and recounting the wonderful deeds of Jesus is part of the formation of the Gospels, of the inspired text. And in a sense, the process continues and does tend to get a bit wilder with the whole Christian legend, because the Gospels, once they got that status of being proclaimed as canonical text, then the church was very careful to try and control exactly what was in them and what wasn't. Whereas the legends appear in all sorts of different editions, with bits added and bits taken away and legends merged. And it's actually very hard to track down what is the oldest part of it, where it came from. And so the study of the apocryphal texts is insanely complicated, and they get translated from one language to another. They get reworked by different authors. And they sometimes are trying to make a teaching point that is part of the mainstream tradition of the church. Other times they've been hijacked by what we would now say are heretical groups. Things like the continuing virginity of Mary is something taught in apocryphal texts. One example of a question that arises is, because we know nothing about the childhood of Jesus, what was he like as a kid? And so there's an infancy gospel of Thomas that fills in some of those details and has Jesus as a lad, making little clay birds and being told off for making them on a Sunday, on a Saturday, on the Sabbath day. And when he's told off, he claps his hands and his clay birds fly away.
Father Murph, you said apocryphal means worth reading.
Yes.
Do you also have, like, if somebody wrote a wonderful story today and said, well, that's worth reading, does the story have to be recognized as apocryphal, or are these all stories that are from before the canonical texts were decided?
The boundaries of, it's largely ancient texts that are talked about when we are talking about apocryphal writings. To list some and approximate dates, you've got the Gospel of Thomas from about 100 AD, the infancy Gospel of James, which I've talked about, mid-second century, the Holy Book of the Great Invisible Spirit, 150 AD, roughly, the Gospel of Truth, the infancy Gospel of Thomas, about 160 AD, a Gospel of Peter, about 190 AD, the Acts of Pilate, mid-4th century, the Syriac infancy Gospel, about 500 AD, Pseudo-Matthew, very important for its depiction of St. Joseph and the story of Joseph, and making Joseph an older man, etc. And that's not until the start of the 7th century. And one of the very influential documents for the life of Mary is a document called The Passing of Blessed Mary by Pseudo-Melito of Sardis, and that's mid-5th century, about 450 AD. So we are talking documents from, let's say, before the 8th century. If you write it today, we'll probably just call it wonderful spiritual reading rather than put it in the category of apocryphal texts. Just to further confuse you, the word apocrypha also comes up with regard to the Old Testament, where there are apocryphal writings, but there are some books in the Old Testament that the Catholics consider to be part of the Bible that Protestants don't, and Protestants refer to those books as apocrypha.
Oh, like the Book of Esther or some?
Exactly. So, and 1 and 2 Maccabees and parts of Daniel and, so that's not what we're talking about. But there are also Jewish legendary writings, like about Aaron and his staff and all sorts of wonderful tales that are based within the Jewish faith. But we're talking about Christian apocrypha, and it's sort of the legendary writing that emerges in the early centuries of the church, and it has a big impact on the art. You talked about not knowing the dialogue between Mary and the angel, but have you considered what was Mary doing when the angel came to her? And if you read the Protoevangelium of James, Mary was weaving the veil of the temple. So this was a task given to the virgins of Israel. Now, this is sort of a reflection on the canonical Gospels, because it says in Matthew's Gospel that when Jesus died, the veil of the temple was torn from top to bottom. So that was sort of when the veil was destroyed. When was the veil made? Well, logically, the veil was made, you know,
by his mother.
By his mother, and the task was given to the virgins of Israel, and different colors were assigned to different people, and the red and the purple was assigned to Mary.
Yeah.
And so you'll often see Mary with a skein of red wool or something in her lap that she's weaving in the oldest infancy narratives, or you get a double annunciation, because there's another story that she was going to the well and taking water from the well, and she hears the voice and looks around but cannot see anyone. And so you actually get a double annunciation, either outside at the well or inside, seated with a work basket beside her and red thread in her hands.
But these stories make it so much easier to find out who is depicted. Because if we only go with a word, then they all look the same, because we don't know exactly how Mary looked like. But if you can give her a few symbols, then you know this is Mary because of the symbols.
Exactly.
And especially when you said that the people were very literate, but when they went to the missions, they came to people who were not literate, and so they had to tell stories and paint.
And artists want a commission to paint or make a statue or create an image of some particular saint. And so, for example, you took of statues of St. Anne. How can we identify St. Anne? So what is the attribute of Anne in art? And the answer is, Anne's characteristic is she's the mother of Mary. So you'll often have Anne depicted with a girl child in her arms. Now, Mary's attribute is that she's the mother of Jesus. So sometimes you get Anne holding Mary holding Jesus, either the three generations done realistically or just bigger to littler going down. Even later again, Anne gets, the story changes and Mary is reading from the prophet Isaiah at the moment of the Annunciation, reading the text, "The virgin will conceive." And so people then asked, where did Mary learn to read? Mm-hmm. And the answer is St. Anne taught her. So there's at a period when the church was out to promote reading for women, they encouraged statues of St. Anne teaching the virgin to read.
In other stories, she's seen as going up the steps to the priest in the synagogue. In the temple.
Now, so again, this is part of the legendary life of Mary, that Mary was taken by her parents, by Joachim and Anne, and taken to the temple, and goes up the steps to Joachim, the high priest, and it said she danced on the steps of the temple, and you get lovely depictions of this, of parents taking a child to effectively boarding school, and you can see how that image has all sorts of power for all sorts of generations of parents who have had to take their child into the care of someone else. Now, according to the legend, Mary stays in the temple and is fed by angels, mm-hmm. Until she reaches puberty. When she starts menstruating, she can no longer remain in the temple because of the sacredness of blood in the Jewish religion. And so the priests of the temple say, what do we do with this holy virgin? We must find a widower who can look after her. who can marry her and keep her safe. Now, I'm not quite sure why it had to be a widower, but this answers another biblical question about the brothers and sisters of Jesus. And so they summon the widowers of Israel, who are each to bring a staff. And they bring their staff, and these staffs are taken into the Holy of Holy and prayed over by the high priest. And then there's no sign on any of the staffs, but he brings them back and gives them back to each of the suitors of Mary. The last staff to be given back is to a carpenter called Joseph. And as given back, now the legend varies, the staff flowers or a bird lands on the staff. But this is the sign that Joseph is to take Mary home.
And that's why there's a lily connected with Joseph.
Exactly. And the different cultures use slightly different flowers for that lily. South America, for example, using the one that's on the Pope's coat of arms.
And so I think also what you just mentioned, Jesus was referring to his brothers and sisters, or to his brothers at least. And I was thinking the other day that here in New Zealand, Maori often say bro or brother. And because if you have a culture that is quite closely knit, then you are relatives in a way, but you call it each other brothers. And we in the Catholic Church, also the priest calls us brothers and sisters. So the question is, did the people in the Middle Ages, for example, did they understand this? Or did they think, no, he must have had siblings, but as Mary was a virgin and she would only have had one child, that's why Joseph must have been a widow so that he had children.
That's basically the what the apocryphal gospel of Pseudo Matthew. That's its answer to that question, because the gospels are very clear on the virginity of Mary prior to the birth of Jesus, but they're silent about after that. So the continuing virginity of Mary is something that the church teaches, but that it's not clearly in the scriptures. And as you say, there's that passage where Jesus comes to Nazareth and they say, isn't this the carpenter's son? Aren't his brothers and names are given and his sisters with us? So, as you say, the whole concept of family is much more elastic and much more complex than our little nuclear family. And so the answer from the apocryphal gospel is, these are the children of Joseph by an earlier marriage. So these are the half-brothers and half-sisters of Jesus. But it can be kazi bros in the Maori expression that can cover all the children of one generation.
Yeah, and I think that when we come to the legends, I think it's also important to consider that the Christians went out as missionaries, and every missionary needs to explain stories a bit in a way that people understand. So it's I'm still wondering how the Christians managed to talk about sheep and being a pastor in countries where there were no sheep, and to talk about the about water and the scarcity of water if it was in an area where there was plenty of water. So I think that there always had to be some kind of adaptation, like kind of target group talking.
Every proclamation, well, one of the things about being a missionary is you're proclaiming the good news, and your hearers will ask questions of you. And the questions vary as the culture varies. So when they were proclaiming Jesus as the Messiah to a Jewish audience, they could assume knowledge of the Old Testament, titles like Son of David, being part of the people of God. All of that made sense to a Jewish audience who were very, very familiar with the Old Testament. Once Christianity sort of explodes out of its original Jewish milieu and spreads out through the Roman Empire, they are proclaiming the story to people who don't know the Old Testament, where one of the things is Christianity's gone through translations the whole way, and most of these early texts are in Greek. Jesus, we believe, spoke Aramaic in a Jewish culture, but the Gospels are written down in Greek. The letters are all in Greek. The New Testament is all Greek with these odd Talitha cum, Alleluia, Amen. We've got these Maranatha. We have these few little phrases from what we believe to be the original language, but Christianity goes through translation, and it's crossing cultures and picking up significances. And so to a Greek audience, if you proclaim Jesus is the Son of God, one of the questions they'll ask is, when did he become the Son of God? And you can actually see the Mark's gospel begins with the baptism of Jesus. And you could imagine, okay, well, he became God's son at his baptism, because that's when a voice from heaven declares, this is my son. Matthew and Luke, written later, both have an infancy narrative and make it clear that from his birth, or in Luke's gospel, from his conception, he is the child of God. John's gospel goes right back to creation. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, making it clear that from the beginning of time, the Son of God was with God. So they're answering questions being asked, and they're answering them in terms that the culture they're talking to will understand.
And that leads very well to my presentation on the nativity scenes on the 6th of December, because depending on the culture, you take certain symbols, especially, of course, from the Gospel of Luke and Matthew, because these are the Gospels with a nativity, with an infancy narrative.
And, of course, the apocryphal Gospels will tell you about Salome, the midwife.
Yes, that's right. Testing the virginity.
Exactly, because you can sort of see that as evolving out of how do we explain the continuing virginity of Mary, and in a very concrete terms, in a culture that is much more bodily, maybe, and more into body fluids than our culture. There's the midwife who tests to see if the hymen is intact. And whose hand shrivels or feels like it's on fire in response to this blasphemous act, until she picks up the Christ child and prays.
But it's also in traditions like in southern Italy and in Sicily, I read that they had used to put out the linen after the night of the wedding night. Mm-hmm. So it was displayed out of the window so that everybody knew everything is okay.
Indeed.
Well, thank you so much, Father Merv. And this has been really enlightening. And we learn a lot about apocryphal texts. So they are worth reading. They didn't make it into the canonical text. So we won't hear about it in the church readings, but we can see it on the art of older churches especially. And so thank you for explaining that further to us.
Thank you, Beate. All the best to you and your listeners.
Thank you. Bye-bye. In the bonds of love we meet, for the world a new day dawning and shine.